I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is Undisclosed Addendum. You may know me from my podcast, Crime Writers On, where we talk about true crime and true crime podcasts and TV shows, but you also might know me as one of the team who makes Undisclosed. I work with the audio the team sends me to put together what you actually hear week to week, and along the way, I come up with a lot of opinions and questions of my own about the cases covered on the podcast. On this episode of Addendum, we're going to be talking about the final episode in the Ronnie Long series on Undisclosed. Long has been imprisoned for 42 years for burglary and rape in Concord, North Carolina, and he says he didn't commit that crime. In the series finale, we heard why his current legal situation is unique and how it compares to the famous thought experiment called Schrodinger's cat. We've got some really special guests to dive into that conundrum and a whole lot more about this case. So our first guest is Jamie Lau. Professor Lau is the current attorney for Ronnie Long and the supervising attorney for the Duke Law Wrongful Convictions Clinic. Previously, he worked for the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission investigating post-conviction claims of innocence. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great. It's also great to have you because we've been listening to you in this series, and you'll be able to just like directly answer questions about some of the WTF things that we heard about in this case. So I'm really happy that you're here.
There's plenty of WTF moments.
It's a technical term. I like it.
It's a legal term. It's like it's a whole like WTF course in law school, right, Colin?
I'll have to create one.
Our second guest is Allison Sweeney. She is an award-winning actress known for Days of Our Lives and The Biggest Loser. And recently it was announced that she will executive produce and star in the Chronicle Mysteries for Hallmark Movies and Mysteries as Robbie McPherson, a first-time podcaster pursuing the cold case of a childhood friend. It sounds right up my alley. Allison, I'm so excited to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I wonder where I came up with that idea. It's just so, so strange.
And also with us is Colin Miller. He is one of the hosts of Undisclosed and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law and the blog editor of Evidence Prof Blog and better known to Crime Writers On fans as Legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. And as we've been saying in our credits, Rebecca's son, Henry, was a big assistant in this case, helping us go through different articles and audio files.
Yeah, he was actually really fascinated. And I should say he's now in Washington, D.C., serving as a Senate page. Before he left, he was really kind of cramming to go through all the documents that you sent him. And he kept turning to me, you know, when he'd be working on his computer and he'd be like, oh, my God, I can't believe what I just read. And it delivered. He was not wrong. On that.
Yeah, that's pretty much my reaction to the entire podcast. I'm like driving along and then I stare at the speakers in my car like, what? And I have to go back.
Yeah. Well, this week's episode was a doozy. In it, the team reported on exculpatory reports from the State Bureau of Investigations that weren't disclosed to the defense until 3 decades later. These reports, which covered the testing of hairs, clothes, and other evidence from the crime scene, led to a split decision of the Supreme Court of North Carolina as to whether to grant Ronnie Long a new trial. And then several years later, when the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission was reviewing the case, it was revealed for the first time that 3 envelopes worth of fingerprints were lifted from the crime scene and that there were 6 alternate suspects in the case, leading to Ronnie Long's current federal appeal. All right, Allison, just like me, I put the series together, but I'm also a listener. Like, I may be the deepest listener of these episodes because, you know, I'm actually putting them together. How much of a shock was it to you, like it was for me, to hear in this week's episode that there was all of this evidence that wasn't disclosed to the defense team for decades?
Yeah, it was, talk about a mic drop. Like, what a huge shocker that was. And I really kind of appreciated later as a storyteller how smart it was to wait and not give away that that was coming in the earlier episodes, because then we got to experience a tiny little bit of how it must have felt for you, Jamie, for you guys investigating the case to sort of discover that after all these years, and for Ronnie himself. I mean, it's really mind-blowing. It's just incredible new information. And to know that they withheld it all that time is just horrifying. I mean, really, it's horrifying to think what people are capable of keeping you from in terms of justice.
Jamie, it was noted in the episode that there's still a lot of information that you don't have, like the exact locations of the fingerprints that were lifted and the reasons why six other men were alternate suspects. How frustrating is that for you? And could you get more information at some point?
It's very frustrating. And certainly we hope to get additional information about especially the alternative suspects at some point in time. The current federal petition that's pending also includes a discovery motion where we ask for the files that resulted in the latent pranks that were discovered being ran against those alternate suspects. So we still hope to get the information as to why those individuals were chosen to compare the latent lifts to. As was mentioned in the episode, there are two names that it was the first time we had ever heard those names associated with this crime and do not appear in any of the files we have. So it's a to be continued circumstance where we believe there's additional information out there, and we'll do what we have to do to attempt to obtain that information, despite the objections of the prosecutors who have been concealing this evidence all along.
Yeah. And Colin, you know, I tweeted this week that I think that millions of people now know what Brady is and what a Brady violation is because of Undisclosed and the work that you guys have done in just explaining these legal concepts. And Brady, of course, refers to the withholding of evidence, you know, to the defense. But you say in this episode that you think the North Carolina courts applied the wrong standard on Brady. Can you just, again, recap when that happened? And then can you explain your thinking on that in more detail?
Yeah, so the court here that denied relief to Ronnie Long said all this new forensic evidence from the SBI, even if it had been turned over, it wouldn't establish by a preponderance the evidence that Ronnie Long would have been acquitted. And by preponderance the evidence, we mean more likely than not. And there was actually, as I noted in the episode, this North Carolina opinion just a few months before the Ronnie Long case, and it was citing to the Supreme Court case, Collins versus Whitley. And that opinion specifically says, if you're claiming a Brady violation, you don't have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence this would have resulted in a different outcome. It just has to undermine our confidence in the jury's verdict. And I think that's essential because the whole point is we didn't get this evidence at the time of trial. There's no way to know exactly what would have happened at trial if all this hair evidence, the clothing evidence came in. And therefore, I think the correct test and the test they should have applied is simply, does it undermine our confidence? And that's the point where we were laying at the end, which is to say, look, there's all types of doubt here created by this evidence. We don't know what the jury would have done, but we know the jury should have had this evidence, and we can't have any confidence in their verdict without that evidence.
But Colin, can I just ask and interrupt here and say, like, you also, I mean, I guess maybe this isn't a fair thing to put before the court, but also, like, who's to say what further investigation would have wrought? Like, what information might we now know if they had got, it's not just the direct evidence that you're talking about, these fingerprints, but like, what if they had run them? What if they had followed up? What if that had led them down another path? And then there might have been another legitimate suspect, but we'll never know that now because they withheld it. Isn't that more than just the actual evidence itself? It's where it could have gone.
Yeah, Allison, that's a fantastic point. And actually, that was my first introduction to the Brady Doctrine. I was a law student, and there is this Supreme Court case, Wood versus Bartholomew. And what it's been interpreted, as many courts have said in that case, is that the failure to turn over inadmissible evidence can never be a Brady violation. And so my very first article I wrote before I became a law professor was on this subject. And to your point, you know, let's imagine we have a case, and let's imagine that a defendant, Dan, has been charged with murder, and the police talk with a witness, Will, and Will says, the word on the street is that Al, this alternate suspect, committed the murder. That's technically hearsay, and according to many states, that means it can't be a Brady violation. But to your point, you know, if that's turned over to the defense, they can hit the streets, they can talk to this witness, they can possibly gather additional admissible evidence that proves this alternate suspect was the killer. And so I think your point is great, and I think the court should be much more willing to find Brady violations than they are.
I agree. And what you're talking about, that kind of example, and I hate to lean on this pop culture reference over and over again, but that's the kind of stuff we see Jack McCoy pull all the time on old episodes of Law and Order, you know, where he toes that line. And like every time we see him do something almost bad on that show, it's exactly this, like a line that could take you somewhere, you know. So right. I just think it's really something how it's not just a cleaner, you know, turn everything over or don't kind of decision, but that you're able to cut these things kind of thinly. It's strange.
And it's also, I think, Colin, you mentioned it on an earlier episode, maybe even not this case, but at one point you kind of brought up that the law, like, it sometimes feels like the justice system is set up to protect itself rather than necessarily like actually trying to find actual innocence or get to the actual truth of the case that we're talking about. You know, it often seems like these it's circular logic just trying to protect itself.
Yeah, it's a great point. And Jamie, I know, you know, this is a case in federal court, and we've discussed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and that creates a tough statute of limitations for defendants. It creates a tough burden of proof. And it really is this legal inertia where really with the AEDPA, it's intentionally, they're trying to prevent defendants from having their convictions overturned.
And I think the adoption of the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act was back in the late 90s, prior to the widespread use of DNA testing. So what it really calls for is rethinking this notion of finality and having these cases litigated quickly and being terminated efficiently. And really considering now that we know that the system gets it wrong, it gets it wrong in more than 2,000 cases, according to the National Registry of Exonerations, rethinking the review given in these post-conviction matters now that the system has been exposed as having these flaws.
Now, you all might think you know exactly what Blue Apron is. We all know that they are the leading meal kit delivery service in the United States. And while a lot of people know what that means, you know what people don't actually understand? If they don't use Blue Apron, the kinds of meals that Blue Apron provides. We're not talking about some plain old burgers. For example, you'll be making short rib burgers with a hoppy cheddar sauce on a pretzel bun. You'll be preparing seared steaks and thyme pan sauce with mashed potatoes, green beans, and crispy shallots, all under 45 minutes and without a trip to the grocery store. You, my friend, will become a gourmet chef with Blue Apron. And you don't have to just cook for yourself with Blue Apron. They've got some great flexible meal plans. You can get a two-person meal, and those are meals that serve two people. You can choose from 8 new recipes per week with a choice to get 2 or 3 of those recipes, whichever ones you want. You can get a family meal plan. They serve 4 people, and you get to choose 4 new recipes a week with a choice to get 2, 3, or all 4 of those recipes every single week. They also have a wine plan that delivers 6 bottles of wine from renowned winemakers that come to you every single month. So forget the stress of coming up with your own meals, trying to dig out recipes, going to buy the ingredients, trying to get the right portions, not wasting extra ingredients, and coming up with something that's outside of your rotation. We all get sick of making the same stuff over and over. Now you can try Blue Apron, and our listeners will actually get $30 off your first delivery. When it comes to dinner, let Blue Apron take care of the planning and shopping while you do the cooking and eating. You're gonna get some delicious meals. Here's some stuff coming up. Popcorn chicken with sweet chili cabbage slaw and cumin-spiced wonton noodles with vegetables and peanuts. Oh my God, that sounds so good. All of this on your tables in 30 minutes or less. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you see what the power of food can do. So check out this week's menu and get $30 off at blueapron.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's $30 off your first delivery if you go to blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Now, Colin, the victim in this case is deceased, is that right?
Yes.
So this is the one thing that it wasn't clear to me, and maybe it's just me kind of like absorbing this much of media of this kind and hearing about this many cases and the cases that I've read about and even written about. Very often it seems to me that the state, and you certainly see this in the Syed case, leans upon what they are messaging the wishes of the victim or the victim's family in order to justify things like keeping somebody in prison even though their conviction has been overturned. You know, they say, you know, they sort of lean on that. I mean, at least I think they do. And that's led to some
public opinion.
Yeah. And that's certainly led to some, I think, quote, victims' rights advocacy work that in a lot of ways, like Marcy's Law, which we've discussed, Colin, before, this national campaign to get states to adopt this constitutional amendment to protect victims, actually inhibits the rights of defendants and people who are defense attorneys and ACLU say that you're actually kind of chipping away at the due process. There's no living victim here. And yet you have this guy who, as you explain in the show, is in this legal limbo. What do they say publicly is the reason for him sitting there? Do they have a message around this?
Yeah, I think I touched upon it a little bit in the episode, and Jamie could probably share some more. But, you know, they wouldn't respond to my calls. I tried a couple times to reach out to the district attorney. And the one comment that they have that they gave to the press when Kayla Ayers was covering this was to say, this is a case where the defendant has changed his story and therefore he's not credible. And I think, as Jamie has said, in my review of the files leads to the same conclusion. His alibi, as far as I can tell, has been consistent for the past four decades. And I can't see where she's even raising a good faith argument to say that he's changed his story.
I also, sorry, but that was such an appalling kind of a brief statement. I mean, given the information that is out now about wrongful confessions and DNA evidence disproving, you know, eyewitness testimony, and just that it seems so, you know, sort of tone deaf as to what is out there right now. I mean, it does seem they're a bit like a dinosaur trying to hang on to an old system as opposed to really coming to terms with, as you suggested, you know, that Rebecca, we should be reevaluating the system and figuring out the right way to deal with where we're at now.
Well, I would just add, and in this case, it's unfortunate that, you know, that approach to defending the eyewitness identification against the weight of all the information we've learned over the last 40 years with respect to eyewitness identifications has been pervasive throughout. It's the argument that's being made in federal court against our having the case heard, arguing that there's no way in which Mr. Long could ever prove his actual innocence because of the strength of the eyewitness identification in the case. Of course, Thomas Albright in the first episode explained how the science with respect to these eyewitness identifications has disproven the strength that they were given at one point in time in court and has shown that the identification in this case is terribly flawed. There's no real good faith wrestling with whether or not the eyewitness identification could be flawed by the state. They just assert it as this certainty of the victim that should carry the day, despite of the weight, demonstrating that Ronnie didn't commit the crime. So
I thought that woman that you talked about, I'm sorry, I wish I could remember her name, who got up there and did the eyewitness and then realized through DNA evidence that she was wrong, and then turns out to be such an advocate for learning that, you know, maybe our eyewitness isn't, your memory isn't what you thought it was fascinating and heartbreaking. And I have to imagine, like, you would believe your own memory. God, that was just such a tragic story. And I was thinking, you know, that needs to be out there more.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Jennifer Thompson is who you're talking about. And she's a remarkable woman.
She is. She is. And she's not succumbing to that prosecutorial pressure. And I do think there is prosecutorial pressure. I mean, I know a lot of lawyers and I, you know, work as a journalist. I've written a bunch of true crime books in which, you know, prosecutors have been a lot of our primary sources. A lot of them are friends of ours, you know, through that process. And New Hampshire is a very different state than a state like North Carolina and a state like Georgia. And, you know, like in Philadelphia, the other cases we heard just in terms of like what they will bring to trial and what they won't. But I also know that these guys, mostly guys, a lot of them are women too, but the ones I've worked with are guys. They're like the most competitive lawyers I've ever met. I mean, if you really think about it, a lot of times it really is about just not getting that L down the road. And I really do think they sometimes in these cases just really put a lot of pressure on victims, on witnesses, to just really hold firm, like as part of their being able to hold on to the win. And it's tough. And when you do hear one person break from that and say, I have new information, that means that I was wrong and I'm sorry and I now want to fight for you, it's incredibly moving. And I really wish that her story would also Allison, maybe you can make a movie out of it, and then
I know.
People will
I was just thinking that we need to cover that more on the CSIs, and we should talk to Jim Clemente on Criminal Minds to cover that. I mean, it is something that needs to be in the public lexicon. I feel it's a bit missed in the Making a Murderer story because of what ended up happening later and what people's opinions are of him. But the truth of the matter is, he didn't rape that woman in the first case. And her, you know, testimony, her drawing of him, sorry, like, I literally am the worst when it comes to terminology, I apologize. But, like, you know, it was totally set up by the officer who put that photo in front of her. And that it got understated, it got lost in the rest of the story. But that's a huge thing that people should keep in mind, even not across, you know, cultural background differences and skin color differences. I mean, it just, you know, there was a guy and he kind of looked similar and...
yeah,
it's horrible.
It was. Well, Jamie, as was in the episode this week, you actually worked for the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, the same commission that rejected Ronnie Long's claim of innocence. What was it like working there, and what is it like kind of going up against that barrier now, having worked there?
My experience there was great. I worked on a couple cases that resulted in exonerations after pretty comprehensive investigations. That experience actually made me frustrated in the circumstance in Ronnie's case, because at my time during the commission, and I was trying to ensure that I wasn't sort of looking back on my time with rose-colored glasses. And I actually asked an attorney that we had worked with during the course of my period of time at the commission. It just seemed they were much more free with information during the course of their investigations to the attorneys on both sides, the state as well as the defense. And when Ronnie's case passed through the commission and we were unable to get information from the commission about the alternate suspects that they had compared the latent lifts to, it was incredibly frustrating because of my past experience and what I viewed as a real willingness to work with both parties to make sure that they were aware of the investigation as it was progressing forward.
Hmm. Now, there's another case that you worked on as lead investigator that I know kind of ties you and Colin together a little bit. And Colin made a note to ask you about it. This is the state versus Kenneth. Is it Caganiera?
Yes, Kenneth Caganiera.
Talk about that case.
It was a remarkable case. The case has actually resulted in the exoneration of five individuals. Those individuals all entered plea deals with the prosecution after they were charged with a home invasion murder. The Caganiera was the defendant who made the push to demonstrate that they were all innocent. He never let it go that he was sitting in prison, despite the fact he entered a plea and he kept asking for DNA testing to be completed in the case. The perpetrators were described as wearing bandanas covering their face, gloves covering their hands when they burst into this home where the victim was living. The bandanas and gloves were all recovered nearby the home down the road where the perpetrators would have been driving down after committing the crime. They had believed that there were drugs in the home, so that's the reason they were invading it, to try and take the drugs from the home. But then they ended up shooting one of the individuals that was present at the home, so they fled right after the shooting occurred. And the bandanas and gloves were recovered down the street. The bandanas and gloves were submitted for DNA testing at the time that the individuals entered their pleas, but the defense attorneys were all trying to secure the best deal on behalf of their client. So they were all more or less pushing the individuals to enter their pleas early so the state would give them the most favorable circumstances at the sentencing. Kenneth got caught up in all of this, entered a plea, but never let go of the notion that there was DNA potential out there, and sought DNA testing shortly after entering his plea, asked for the results. Interestingly, a couple years after this went down, an individual was arrested by federal investigators on a drug trafficking charge. At the time he went to prison on that drug trafficking charge, he contacted an ATF officer that he had a relationship with, and seemingly because he wanted this to be the one time he was in prison, he wanted to get his past criminal conduct all resolved, during this one time he was in prison, he told the ATF officer how he and two other individuals were the perpetrators in the crime that Kenneth Caganiera and the four other individuals were in prison for. Kenneth Caganiera continued to push for DNA testing, and ultimately what occurred was the DNA testing on the gloves and bandanas that were collected actually matched the individual who was in prison for the federal drug crime and the individuals that he named as the participants in the murder didn't match any of the individuals who had entered pleas after being charged with the murder. And then all sorts of interesting conduct by law enforcement came to light, including a video from a gas station that was a security camera video that the note on the property control form when the video was collected indicated that suspects had walked into the gas station, which was just down the street from the house where the crime occurred, at an hour just before the crime occurred. And when we began looking at the case, what we discovered was that video at the period of time when the suspects were supposed to be entering had been recorded over by a Days of Our Lives soap opera segment.
Hey, now there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. You gotta watch your soap. Okay.
Yeah. So Allison, interestingly, it was a Days of Our Lives soap opera segment that had been recorded over the exact period of the videotape when the suspects were supposed to appear.
I mean, what are the odds of that? I can't believe we're...
Well, to be fair, Allison, Days of Our Lives has been on for a very long time. So.
Yeah.
It probably accounts for like 5% of the DVR space being taken up by Americans right now. So
We were so happy that it was a soap opera, though, Allison, because soap operas, as we understand it, and you obviously would know more about this than I would, but don't show reruns on the networks.
That's right.
So we knew that the soap opera had appeared on CBS and
NBC.
Sorry.
But right. It would only air the one time. I mean, it would only air from 12 to 1. Or, you know, whatever in that local time, it could have been anywhere between like 12, 1 and 2. Oh my God, I love that I'm a part of this case.
By the way, and I am so excited because I'm always trying to insert soap opera stuff into all of our crime discussions. Because the other thing of interest there is that if there's a breaking news story that's local during your soap opera, like you miss it. You just don't get another chance to see it again, and it's tremendously frustrating. That's a great, like, so that helped that it was Days of Our Lives?
We were able to timestamp when the video was recorded over because we were able to ascertain when that given episode had appeared. It was amazing. So we were able
to. What year is this?
Yeah, was Allison in it?
This was, now you're really testing my memory. I believe this was 2000, September of 2000.
Oh, this could have been. It,
Sammy, your face covered up this, this evidence.
I used to record over them so often because, you know, I was a fan before I got the job that you could actually see previous, you know, like it's just VHS tape, you know, and you would see earlier, you could kind of see the shadow of what, I'm sure not for your purposes, but you could see the previous stuff. All right, carry on with your story, Jamie. You have me like I'm riveted here.
So what happened then?
Wait. So since you
slow
said
down, I'm writing. I'm taking notes.
Allison, I'm going to break your heart because I'm double checking since you said NBC and I was certain it was on CBS. I have to break your heart.
Oh no!
Was it The Young and the Restless?
Don't mention their names. I'm
looking now. I pulled it up and appears to be another competitor.
Oh, competitor.
No.
That's okay.
It's damn still, you.
Our genre did help this case.
Your genre helped this case, and the fact that they don't repeat on network channel was extremely helpful. And we were able to identify the recording being made over the tape on the very day that they took out the arrest warrants for the individuals.
Oh.
Charged.
Wow. And in the middle of the day, I mean, not like, I mean, it had to have happened at a specific time. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, we can narrow it down more or less to the minute by the transcript and where it was at the episode.
I would love to have been in the room with all of the legal researchers and investigators when they had to pour through weeks of like As the World Turns or Young and the Restless or whatever it was to find the moment that like Victor slapped Nikki, and like, that was when they taped over the tape.
Rebecca,
as you know, Rebecca, there's a whole writer's room. They can pull that stuff up like in an instant. I mean, they know.
Rebecca, it was easier than that. All we did, there was some audio in the soap opera, and we had the dialogue between the two actors that were appearing. We just typed that dialogue into a search engine, and the episode's transcript pulled up. And then when the episode's transcript pulled up, we clicked on the episode, and there was a picture of the same two actresses wearing the exact same clothes.
Wow.
Chatting with each other from that clip that happened to be in the video.
That's amazing. That's amazing. This is like the most amazing thing.
It was the daytime fan base that actually saved the day, because they are the ones that like are so loyal
and insist on having the transcripts.
That's right.
Oh my God. Wow.
So they all entered pleas. The DNA eventually exonerated them with the help of some information that we learned about the law enforcement investigation that put in a negative light, including recording over suspects in a video with a soap opera.
Wow.
Now, Colin, how are you tied to all of this?
Yeah, so my current project is this. Imagine a case like that. Let's say it is sexual assault and a homicide, and a 20-year-old is charged with a crime. He has a public defender. He's facing the death penalty. He's behind the eight ball. He enters into a plea deal. He pleads guilty. And then, as in the Ronnie Long case, there's a missing rape kit. It appears maybe decades later, and this defendant wants to move for post-conviction DNA testing. Maybe there's even a serial rapist in the area who meets the description of the assailant in this case. And essentially, there's a number of states, including Pennsylvania and Maryland, that say if you pleaded guilty, you cannot use post-conviction DNA testing, and you're out of luck. And of course, in Jamie's case, these are people who pled guilty, and in North Carolina, they were able to get testing and ultimately prove their innocence. And essentially, these states say it's almost a mockery on the court to plead guilty and then seek this DNA testing after the fact. But as Allison noted, we have a very different conception now of false confessions than we did when these statutes first took effect. And in fact, in 2015, 65 cases involved people who had pleaded guilty and then proved their innocence through post-conviction DNA testing. So my research project this summer, the article is arguing that there is this right that defendants should have to be able to seek testing regardless of whether they pleaded guilty.
Right.
Also because they've created a system in which, you know, especially with how busy, or I mean, I love how I say this with confidence. I don't even play a lawyer on TV. But it seems to me from what you see in all this stuff that the public defenders are so busy and overwhelmed with work in so many cases that the system is really set up to take a plea, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's really often the safest course of action. And so you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, right? I mean, what did you say that judge said, Colin, like he can't win for losing or something?
Right.
It just seems like they're setting people up for that. So to plead innocent and hope, you know, for DNA to set you free is a real long shot.
It really is. Not to mention that a lot of guilty pleas don't come with confessions. They're just guilty pleas, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's right. Like a lot of people just plea to get as little time as possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has nothing to do with, you know, I mean, confessions. I mean, I understand that people still think like, I can't believe people would ever confess. I mean, we obviously know now that that's just like a BS argument. But for the few people who don't, it seems like even those people would have watched enough procedurals on TV to understand that sometimes you just take a plea so that you don't have to go to trial, or that you don't have to risk being in prison for 50 years or whatever. Like, that's a thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think the ability to get the DNA testing done should be a given. I'm guessing it sounds like Allison agrees with me.
Totally.
Yeah. And Allison, your confidence in your position is warranted, because a few years ago, there were these twin Supreme Court cases. There were Lafler versus Cooper and Missouri versus Fry. And those are cases that said there is a right to the effective assistance of counsel in connection with plea bargaining. And the reason the court reached that conclusion is exactly to your point. They're saying, look, we're no longer a system of trials here in this country. And any look at the rights that criminal defendants have has to recognize the fact that we expect plea bargains. And I think that analysis is part of what I'm arguing in the piece, is to say you have to recognize this for post-conviction DNA testing too. And so that's a big thrust of the article.
Rebecca, can we take a second to talk about Colin? Like, if Colin were your teacher, how good you would feel every day. You'd be like, I mean, just the, yeah, you're right. You are so on the right track there. I mean, I have this huge grin on my face. Like, yeah, I'm learning a lot here.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, if you know Colin even a little bit, he actually avails himself of his knowledge to you on demand and gives you that feedback on demand, even on Twitter. Like, guys, tweet to Colin. He'll tell you that you're smart and he'll tell you what you want to know. And Colin, I will tell you, every time you tweet every week about how you can't wait to listen to my podcast, I do feel that glow, like, of the favorite student. And I know that your class must be the most fun one at the law school.
Yeah, he's the favorite. For sure.
Easy.
Yeah.
Squarespace is encouraging our listeners to make it. Do you have an interest or area specialty you want to share with the world? Make it yourself. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website. Do you currently have a website that isn't living up to its potential? Make it stand out. With Squarespace, you can quickly create a website that is both beautiful and easy to navigate. Whether it's sharing your thoughts on true crime or selling homemade scarves and sweaters, Squarespace should be your go-to site for setting up or fine-tuning your website. With Squarespace, you can turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, promote your physical or online business, or announce an upcoming event or special project. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. So listeners, you can go to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Now, Allison, I just want to take a quick turn here. Your introduction. You are executive producing and starring in a new project for Hallmark about a writer and podcaster investing in a cold case. It's called The Rebecca Lavoie Story. I'm sorry. That's not what it's called.
I was just going to say, it's all sounding very familiar to you.
But actually, I'd love to hear about the series and why you wanted to be involved in it. I actually can guess why you wanted to be involved in it, but just tell us about that project.
Yeah, mostly it's to do with the fact that I'm obsessed with these true crime podcasts, and I had to justify to my husband why I
Research.
Spent so much time listening to them. Yeah, exactly. I've been doing a bunch of movies with Hallmark, and I love doing them. I love the murder mystery framework, and it's really making a comeback. Hallmark has done some really fun series in this space, and I did a few movies for them a couple years ago. What I love about this series is I think it's capturing what's just like taken off like gangbusters this last year is these podcasts. And I know you guys have been at it a while longer than that. You really set the tone and got people interested like me. And so I thought it would be a really fun in for the audience and maybe, you know, get some podcast listeners over to Hallmark to listen to watch, you know, how a would-be or ingenue podcaster might find herself in, you know, real life crime. I mean, obviously I have to take some stretch here, but it's sort of the modern day Jessica Fletcher idea where, you know, she thinks she's covering a cold case. And, you know, for me as a storyteller, cold cases are interesting because as listening to all of you, a lot of it's not on the internet. A lot of it, you do have to go and meet someone and talk to them and get them to tell you what they know or look through microfiche, which anyone, you know, in high school today would not know what that means. but I just thought it was fun and interesting. And I've listened to a few where, like, you know, there's somebody out there who got away with it, who has a really good reason to keep it a secret and might kill for it. So right. I thought that was a great, fun way for me to get into a space that I'm already in love with and fascinated by and celebrate that and hopefully attract a new audience to it.
Well, there is this whole thing happening around true crime podcasts. And anyone who listens to my show will know that, like, it's not all good, but there's a lot of good stuff going on out there in terms of actually making movement in like real life cases, bringing attention to real life cases and having things actually come to some sort of, if not solution, like go toward one. I mean, look at the news in the Adnan Syed case last
Colin
year.
Susan and Robbie are the groundbreakers.
Yeah. And what's really interesting about the ruling last week by the Court of Special Appeals is, you know, you can say that the ruling in the first appeal, the one that was by Judge Welsh, that undisclosed the work that you guys did, especially in bringing that cell phone cover sheet to life and all that stuff, really moved that. And then this week, the ruling that we just had kind of goes back to the serial question, right? About Asia McClain, which was sort of the central thing in that. And at least in the first few episodes of Serial, like when Sarah Koenig said to Asia McClain, I think you might be that person. I think you might be, you know, the missing piece here. So, Jamie, here's my question for you. You are a lawyer working on a really difficult case where a guy's been in prison for 42 years. What do you think about this true crime podcast and appeal kind of crossover victory situation? And what led you to agree to have Undisclosed cover this case?
The first thing I can say is I hope you're right. That podcast, in fact, appeals. Obviously, we're still litigating Ronnie's case, and any beneficial outcome as a result of podcast, you know, divine intervention, voodooism, whatever it is, we would appreciate it. It's been 42 years. The real reason that we wanted to be a part of this project is Ronnie specifically thinks his case needs to be known, and we're really appreciative of the opportunity for people throughout the country to hear about what has occurred to Ronnie in his case. Second, just the transparency that the podcast brings to the criminal justice system and how the appeals in these innocence cases work, the challenges. We were talking earlier with respect to the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. At the time that that was passed in the late 90s, it wasn't common knowledge amongst the country that innocent people were sitting in prisons. And today we know they are. And we now also know through these podcasts the difficulties raising their claims of innocence and litigating those through the courts. And hopefully through these podcasts, at the very least, courts, whether or not it occurs in Ronnie's case or not, will be giving more process to these cases and considering them more in-depthly than they otherwise might have without a light being shown on them.
Now, Colin, you and Rabia and Susan kind of take turns selecting and researching cases for Undisclosed. And I'm wondering, what is your motivation, you know, when you look at a case to say, yeah, this is the one that I think we should cover? Is it about that justice for the wrongfully convicted? Is it, does there need to be some really sticky legal questions that you can get all legal Siri on and explain? Like, what makes you choose the ones you choose?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's sort of a combination of things. So like the Philadelphia cases, we knew that Larry Krasner was likely to be elected, and we thought it was perfect timing to present those cases and hopefully grease the wheels on those people being exonerated. Other times it is a legal issue I want to explore. So our next series we're doing, there's a legal doctrine called the Doctrine of Chances that I teach in evidence, and I think it's a terrible doctrine. It was used in the Michael Peterson case, the famous staircase case, and we're covering it in another case involving a turkey farmer, and I really wanted to explore that. Overall, it is a case where we look at a case and come in with a presumption this person is guilty, and we want the filings in the case, the attorney, the evidence to point us to a belief that this person was wrongfully convicted. And that's what we want to do. We want to take cases where we think people were wrongfully convicted, and we think we can help, either through just giving it attention on the podcast, additional investigation, helping with the legal team, but in some way we can make a difference in the case.
Now, Allison, I know that you, because I follow you online and stuff, love these kinds of stories where there's like injustice and it's kind of just being put out there and those WTF moments like we talked about. You know, one of the things I think about a lot, and I'm wondering if you do too, is how much these stories are bringing to light something to a lot of, you know, I look at the demographics even of my podcast, the ones that I can see from our audio hosts, like middle class, middle American people who have no intersection with the justice system. I mean, that seems to be like who a lot of my listeners are. And I think these shows are doing like a tremendous service, like just opening these issues up. Is that something that you think about too?
So, yeah, I think like there's a lot of different ones out there. I'm interested in just covering cases. I think it's interesting, you know, of serial killers, you know, the Mindhunter type thing, I think is fascinating. But what Undisclosed has done that's really, really groundbreaking, just from like mind blowing from like that emoji, you know, where like your brain is coming off. It, for me personally, was just that it makes you question what I always thought to be true. Like I am that demographic, right? Where I just, and my husband is a police officer, right? I always just sort of assumed that everyone follows the rules and everyone is doing the best they can. And sure, accidents happen and maybe you really thought he did it, but like, I don't know, you know, I mean, like Andy Griffith Show type stuff. I genuinely always believed that. And I know that sounds naive, but like, I think most people did. And then you come upon these cases where you're like, God, I'm so glad I don't live in that town, you know, where they get away with it, where there's no checks and balances, where like sheriffs, as you discussed in season two, Colin, like the sheriffs are elected and they kind of get to run the town in a way that is really not what's intended. And the FBI, from what I understand, is supposed to be running checks and balances on that. And it doesn't really work that way. And as well as it should, and oftentimes isn't just, you know, an error or incompetence, but can often be intentional. And that was really like, once you sort of have to open your mind to that, you know, as much as each of these individual cases need attention, I feel like I'm so impassioned at the idea of like a bigger comprehensive change to the system where prosecutors are rewarded for doing the right thing and figuring out who really did it, as opposed to, as you said, like they are obviously competitors and hardworking, tough-minded people who believe in right and wrong and justice and criminals and whatnot and putting criminals away. And I feel the same way, but like not when they didn't do it, you right. know? I mean, so I wish, you know, I don't know. I love it. I'm fascinated by it. And I do think there is like, you know, sort of a mooring. Oh my gosh, I have to stop talking. I feel like, why am I still talking? Sorry.
No,
I find
no, no.
I'm it's, passionate about
but,
it.
But you, wait, what you're talking about is exactly what I was, I mean, look, you're like on fire, just thinking about all the issues that have come up for you and listening to this material and like, and thinking about these cases. And one of the things that's always been interesting to me is the sort of this like, I think a popular narrative of like a bad apple, right? Like the one bad cop who like wronged right. like a couple of people. But what we've learned is, yes, there are sometimes bad actors. Like in this case, it was the identification officer, Van Eisenhower, who apparently is might have some suspect motivations. In the Michael Peterson case,
that guy.
the expert, the blood expert who did all the fake BS tests and like just made up data.
And how many hundreds of cases did he
exactly
ruin?
But for the most part,
who might have done it, right?
Right.
Like some people who might actually be guilty, but he is so flawed in his methods that you can't take him at all seriously.
Right. And I think though, to me, and I think that the thing that like is most exciting for me to have America learn about, not just America, but the world learn about, is that a lot of these cases, it's not somebody who went to work that morning saying like, I want to screw Adnan Syed. It's somebody right. who went to work that morning in a system designed to immediately find somebody you think did it and then make all the pieces fit because that's just how they do the job. That's just how they do the job. And we're seeing that over and over and over again.
And I can't stress enough the other element of this that's sort of mind-blowing, which is then even with like DNA proof that he didn't do it. I mean, not that that's on the story, unfortunately, if only there were DNA, but that there's so many instances in which there really is sort of like a smoking gun. And yet the court system is so convoluted and complex and right. complicated that you can't just be like, oh, hey, by the way, guess what I found, and like let him out of jail.
Yeah, that's really not part of this appeal. You're going to have to go back for 12 more years and fight that fight. Sorry.
And argue whether or not he waived. Like, for example, Colin, the waiving of the cell tower evidence really does like frustrate me because I feel like I don't understand. I mean, I appreciate, thank God they did come down the way they did, and I'm not going to be ungrateful. But honestly, like, I don't understand why they reversed that decision because it, as you said in the podcast, like it's not the same issue. It's a different issue of another example of how she was bad at her job. I just don't understand why our system is so like, if you don't get it right the first time, sorry, you don't get another chance.
Yeah. It's like that game Sorry, where like you push the thing and if you know, you don't get the right one, you get all the way back to the beginning again. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, Jamie, I have a question for you. You know, in the episode this week, this is a couple of like details that kind of came out, but there was that fingerprints into APHIS. The Concord Police Department entered the crime scene, and those fingerprints did go into the system and deliver a report indicating that there were, quote, no possible matches and that this was an invalid result. What did you mean by that? We talked about that in the episode. What was that issue there?
It's just the phrasing of that is incongruent with how the system works. The mm-hmm. system is just based on an algorithm. So there's all these known prints that exist within the APHIS system. And there's an unknown print that is given markings and then entered into that system. The system then takes the markings, and the markings are like where ridges are on the print and other things. The system then takes the markings on the unknown print, applies an algorithm to it that gives it a score with respect to how closely it matches any other prints that are known prints that exist in the system. And it returns the prints that are the highest scored using the algorithm. So it always returns possible contributors. It's always going to give you the prints that are in the system that are known prints that are scored highest when the algorithm is applied to those prints. So the language that there's no possible contributors was very problematic when we obtained the report, especially in light of the additional information we learned about the system and its use by the Concord Police Department. The fact that they indicated to us in a document that they apply the same standards, operating procedures, our State Bureau of Investigation, while that conclusion would be an inappropriate conclusion based on those standards that the State Bureau of Investigation have for the system. And there's a reason why that wouldn't be an approved response or conclusion. It's because it's simply not how the system works.
Right, right. This is like also a case in which a lot of very scientific sounding words were used with this footprint analysis, you know, the oblique lighting and the caliburst biters and all this stuff, which is basically just like, okay, I'm looking at this and looking at this, and I'm just deciding that they look alike or don't look alike.
Pretty much, yeah.
Allison, did you have any other questions about the case that you wanted to ask Jamie or Colin?
Yeah, so you said you're at the federal state now. Like, the other frustrating thing for me as a, you know, and Rebecca, you too, right, is like how long this process takes, right? How it just seems like every step is molasses in January. What, Jamie, are the next steps and what is he hoping for? What's he expecting to happen next and when?
Well, we're awaiting a decision by the district court with respect to two things. First, we have our habeas petition filed. So a decision on the petition itself is sometime off in the future. There's also a pending discovery motion. There could be some interim steps between the final resolution on the habeas petition by the district court if it grants discovery, which would provide us with an opportunity to gain the additional information that we believe is still out there and use that information as needed for the existing litigation that's ongoing. So the district court is going to ultimately make a decision sometime in hopefully not too distant future. And then it has the ability to vacate Mr. Long's conviction. And we certainly hope that it does that in light of all the new evidence that is now known.
So the situation with Adnan Syed, would you then anticipate, I mean, like, are there still the same options apply? If the federal court vacates it, can the state then come back and try again or decide what to do at that point?
Yeah, they could retry Mr. Long if it's vacated. The more likely scenario is that they'd move to stay the decision while they appeal it to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So ultimately, we anticipate one way or another that there'll be an appeal to the Fourth Circuit, and then we'll just have to await their decision. So unfortunately, the delay in these cases is just really unacceptable given that Ronnie has been in prison for 42 years now, but it's something we're forced to live with because there's no deadlines for actions to be taken.
Jamie, are there any other WTF facts or pieces of evidence that, you know, maybe Colin didn't have time to include in the podcast that you would like people to know, even if it's just something about Ronnie that you would like people to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that I'm not sure was clear in the fourth episode, though it probably was, and I'm just misremembering, is the latent fingerprints that were taken from the victim's home, Miss Boss' home, they didn't match her and they don't match Ronnie Long. Mm. So there is certainly the possibility that the individual who committed the crime is the individual who left those prints. And we still would like some additional information about those prints. On Ronnie, just I want to express to everybody involved with the Undisclosed podcast how appreciative he is towards anyone who takes time to look at his case, to learn about his case, and support him in his 42-year effort to prove his innocence. I can tell you when we got involved in the case in 2015, there wasn't much hope that anything could be done. And we've reached a point where we think that there is hope that his conviction can ultimately be vacated. And he's eternally grateful for reaching this point and for people continuing to care about him 42 years later.
And while people are listening, I mean, we've gotten some comments on Twitter. You know, people say, is there really no remedy for bad faith here shown by the state? The last episode of the Ronnie Long case left me furious, says Brooke. The case is unreal, says Tiffany. Colin, do you have any final thoughts about the Ronnie Long case before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that has really struck our listeners, social media, emails, people reaching out. Were they to see this as so egregious by the state? And I think Jamie has expressed this a lot of times too. It's the fact that this exculpatory evidence just keeps trickling out and the state keeps saying, that's all the evidence we have. And it turns out there's more evidence and there's more evidence. And as Jamie said, there's currently a discovery motion where we still don't know things like the location of the fingerprints. And it's just so frustrating that this man has been in prison for 42 years based upon probably the shakiest identification procedure I've ever seen. And he just doesn't have access to all the evidence that he needs to be able to establish his innocence. And
right.
I hope it's something that in the near future, you know, barring anything else, he just gets a full picture of what all the evidence is so that he can make these appeals and have judges hear the merits of his claims.
And I just add to that, Colin, I think he does have the evidence in his case to establish his innocence. And what's frustrating is that the existing evidence really makes plain that things went off the rails in his case. And there's even more evidence to add to that. That would be cumulative evidence of his innocence that continues to be concealed. So it's really frustrating that in light of the evidence that's currently known, it's clear that Ronnie is innocent, but there's even more that we can't get access to that we think will just drive home the point.
Yeah, and I agree with Jamie that I think there's certainly enough evidence now to find a Brady violation and to grant a new trial. It's just, as we often see, it's never a slam dunk. And yeah, I certainly hope he gets relief, but having that extra evidence that Jamie mentioned could even make it an easier case to prove this violation.
Well, Colin Miller, host of Undisclosed, law professor, my legal Siri, and of course, associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Thank you for bringing this case to Undisclosed. It was a pleasure to edit the show. This case was fascinating and really a pleasure to listen and get the chance to talk to you about it. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And Jamie Lau, Professor Lau, a current attorney for Ronnie Long and the supervising attorney for the Duke Law Wrongful Convictions Clinic. Tell Ronnie we're all thinking about him and that his story is one that we won't soon forget. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Allison Sweeney, master of everything, television, true crime, podcasting. Thank you so much for joining this panel. It was so exciting for me to get to talk to you and get to hear thoughts on the criminal justice system and this case.
It sounds like we have a lot more to talk about, Rebecca. It was super fun. Thank you.
And I'm Rebecca Lavoy. You can follow my podcast at Crime Writers On and tune in a couple of weeks for some new stories from the Undisclosed and Addendum teams. Follow Undisclosed Pod on Twitter. Colin, do you want to just mention your Twitter handle real quick if people want to ask you more legal questions?
It is at EvidenceProf.
And Jamie, are you on social media at all? Can people follow you?
Yeah, I'm at Lau, L-A-U, Durham.
All right. And I'm at Reb Lavoy. And of course, you can follow at Undisclosed Pod. For everyone at Undisclosed and the Addendum, including our amazing executive producer, Methil Telhan, and audio editor, Hannah McCarthy, thank you so much. It was a pleasure hosting the show.